Hey there, I'm so pumped to tell you about an amazing new community I've launched called Grief to Growth Circle Community. It's a space for people who are grieving to come together to support each other and for people who want to know who we are, why we're here, and where we're going to have those conversations, all the things we talk about on the podcast. So I invite you to join me at grieftogrowth.com/community to become part of this compassionate crew. The best part is 100% free. And you have access to me in addition to everybody else in the community. In fact, the podcast will be there so you can talk about the things we talk about in the podcast right there in the community. There's also some premium content if you want to go deeper in the work I'm doing, but mostly it's about building relationships and community and about sharing resources and supporting each other. So come on over and check it out. It's grieftogrowth.com/community. I'll see you inside.
Hi there. Welcome to Grief to Growth Podcast. Your host is Brian Smith, spiritual seeker, best-selling author, grief survivor, and life coach. Brian believes that the worst tragedies of life provide the greatest opportunity for growth. Brian says he was planted, not buried, and he is here to help you grow where you've been planted by the difficulties in life. In each episode, Brian and his guests will share what has helped them to survive and thrive. It is his sincere hope this episode helps you today.
Hey, everyone. This is Brian Smith back with another episode of Grief to Growth. And I've got with me today a new author. His name is David Ditchfield. And David had a near-death experience that is really amazing. But the really cool thing about David's near-death experience, the thing that I think makes it more interesting than some, is what happened, the after effects of his NDE. And we'll talk about those today. So let me just read David's introduction and then we'll get started with our conversation. David is an NDE-inspired artist, composer, and author. He wants to use his NDE to make a positive difference in people's lives. In 2006, David was dragged under a speeding train in a freak accident. And as the surgeons fought to save him, he had a profound NDE. When he woke up in the hospital, he required new, astonishing abilities. He found that he could paint dramatic paintings of what he had seen in the afterlife, far beyond any artistic ability he had before. David then discovered he could compose classical music, having never received any training in classical music. To this day, he says he cannot read or write a single note of musical notation, and yet his debut NDE-inspired symphony, which is called The Divine Light, was premiered at a sellout orchestra concert to a standing ovation. And David since then has composed further classical works, which have also been premiered at sellout concerts. And David has completed over 40 paintings. David currently lives in a converted riverside mill near Cambridge in the UK. I want to give David's website. We're going to talk about that also. It's shineonthestory.com. That's shineonthestory.com. And with that, I'd like to welcome David Ditchfield. David, welcome to Grief to Growth.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for having me on.
Good David, to be here. I'm really excited to get a chance to talk to you today. I was telling you before we got started, I got an email from your publicist about reading your book. And I get these, you know, occasionally people want me to read their books and bring them on the show. And I thought, yeah, you know, I'll read the book. It's another guy that had an NDE. But first of all, the book is really, really well written. I mean, I started reading the first part of it. I'm like, am I reading the right book? Because it reads like a novel. It's really well written. It draws you right into the story. Tell me about your experience and share as much as you or little as you like about, you know, what happened to you.
Yeah, well, basically what happened to me was I was seeing a friend off at the rail station in Cambridgeshire. And I'd been staying at my sister's for a few days just to sort of chill out for a bit because my life had pretty much hit hard times. So my sister said, come and hang out up here. So I was there actually for a few weeks. And a friend of mine had just come up to visit from London and she was going back on the train. So I was seeing her off, helped her onto the carriage with her bags, as it were, you know, and gave her a hug and a kiss to say goodbye. And then the emergency door sort of thing, buzzer started going. And so she said, come on, you're going to have to get off. I said, yeah, yeah, don't worry, I'm cool. But as I stepped back, it wasn't cool because the bottom part of my coat, I was wearing like a sheepskin coat that day, just got caught in the doors and it was trapped. So I tried everything I could to release my coat, but it wasn't happening. So I turned around and looked for a guard and shouted for help, you know, frantically. But no one turned up. There was no guard. In fact, there was only one other guy on the platform, and he said, take your jacket off, mate, you know. But there was no way that was going to happen because the thickness of this coat was like pretty dense, and I knew it just wouldn't, in the time, it wouldn't happen. Mm-hmm. So I was banging the windows, trying the electric door buttons at the side, but nothing. And then I remember looking into the eyes of my friend, Anna, who I was seeing off, and the look of horror in her face was not surprising because we knew what was about to happen, that the train was just revving up the engines to leave. So it pulled out of the station and started pulling off pretty fast speed, and I lost my footing, and then I was dragged along the platform and then through the space between the platform edge and the actual, the train itself. And then I went through, and I was just pulled down, right down into complete darkness and hell. You know, it was just horrific. So I figured at that point that I was going to die. I didn't think there was no way I was going to survive this. I remember actually just seeing, like, I heard this tremendous rip at this point, and then I just looked up and I saw what looked like the carriage doors disappearing up into the sky. And I went down into this darkness. I was tossed around like a rag doll. I was just like banged around from side to side, pillar to post, as it were, you know. Mm-hmm. And it felt like I'd been thrown into a spin dryer, you know, sort of, or whatever, yeah, on full speed. It was incredibly stressful and painful, but I never lost my conscious. I was fully conscious throughout the whole ordeal. Mm-hmm. And then finally, I hit the ground and I was laid down between the tracks, and the train was still, at this point, was still racing above my head at tremendous speed.
So at this point, you're underneath the train as it's passing over you. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I figured even though I'd been, you know, released from everything, that it wasn't over yet, you know, that I thought something, some undercarriage or whatever could just kind of whack me over the back of the head and that would be it. So I just kept my head right down into the gravel. I can remember the smell of the oil, and it was just really intense. And then the sound of the train was rattling above over my head. And eventually it passed. It moved on. And I realized that I was alive. So it was incredibly beautiful to know that. But also I was in immense pain. And I looked to see what the damage was. And this once beautiful, rich sheepskin coat I talked of was now ripped to shreds, all from the arm down anyway. And also, so was my arm. In fact, my arm had been cut off, the top half of it had been cut open and cut off. So there was a lot of mess, and I was in a lot of pain. And but the odd thing was, I just figured, all right, I better get my cell phone out and call my sister and let her know what had been, but it happened, so she could alert the emergency services. And of course, that wasn't going to happen. You know, the phone wasn't working, and people had suddenly arrived anyhow. They were there really, really quick. And, you know, these guys jumped down onto the track, and you know, the emergency services were there, and they cut my clothes open and got me onto a stretcher and got me into hospital, you know, pretty quick. And when I arrived in the hospital, there was like a big team of doctors and surgeons and nurses all there waiting, like in a big semicircle, I remember, as I looked. And I went straight into this bay, and then they were all running around frantically trying to save me. At this point, I was losing copious amounts of blood from the injuries. And My family arrived really quick, and so they came in to see me. And I remember my mother was in tears. She was going, you know, and I was going, "Mom, I'm so sorry. It's always me messing up and causing all the dramas in the family, you know." And of course, she said, "Don't apologize, you know." So she was just glad I was alive. And then I saw my friend Anna, and I wanted to speak to her. She was just sat at the back. I said, "Can I speak to Anna?" So she stepped forward and we spoke. And I remember she was just shaking her head in complete disbelief that this had happened. And it was at that point that the pain got so immense that I left my body. And I left the whole sort of, you know, complete sort of overkill of noise and light in the hospital to this beautiful, dark, warm place. And I figured at first I was in a very small, darkened space, although it was a lovely darkened space. Mm-hmm. And the first thing I noticed around me were like these kind of orbs that were like pulsating all around me, like these beautiful colors, like sort of oranges and ambers, yellows and blues, and just slowly pulsating. And I felt very calm just looking at these. And I thought, where am I? You know. And the next thing, I looked and just I could feel this. Well, I could feel this a sense of somebody or somebody there with me. Mm-hmm. And I looked at my feet, and right to the right hand of my feet, I could see this being of light. It was like a beautiful androgynous being, wearing like a simple black contemporary T-shirt. You know, nothing ethereal at all. Just very, you know. Mm. And this androgynous being had this like sort of like skin that was radiating light from within, you know, so it was very luminous skin, and the hair was kind of like a white sort of blonde hair, I guess. Mm-hmm. And the eyes were just staring at me. But when I say they were staring at me, they were kind of, there was a calmness, there was like a smile in their eyes. Mm. And I felt the sense of a protection, overwhelming sense of protection and love coming from this androgynous being. And but not only that, I felt like I'd known him or her for the whole of my life and beyond, you know. And so there was this real connection there, like a soulmate, if you like, like I'd known this person really. And I lay my head back and I thought, this is it. I've died. This is the next stage where we go to. And I was quite happy with that. I had no sense of like sort of, oh, no, I'm dead. You know, it was like this, right. Okay. I'm dead. This is it. You know, that's cool. Uh-huh. As I laid back, I remember looking up and I could see like these three grids of white light suddenly started to come in towards me. Mm-hmm. And this intense, pure white light, it was amazing. And it was just very, very bright. And I couldn't take my gaze away from the light. Even though it was so bright. I mean, you know, if it had been electric light or even the sunlight itself, of course, I never would be able to look because it would be too piercing. But this, I just couldn't stop looking at. And because it felt like the energy that was coming from this light was healing me. And it was just beautiful. And it was at that stage, I suddenly thought I'd got two other. Well, I thought I got more presence within me in this space. Mm-hmm. And I looked, and either side of me were these two beings, a female form. One was sort of, I suppose, either Asian or American Indian in her look, and the other one was more sort of like white Caucasian and brown hair and brown eyes. And they were both hovering their hands over my body, and they were kind of like almost protecting me and giving me this energy that was like healing my soul, if you like. Because mm-hmm. as I looked down, I looked at my body to check out my wounds, which I knew had been pretty bad, and my arm was fine. It was reconnected. In fact, you know, I got no clothes on other than being covered by this blue sort of like a beautiful silk cloth, you know. It was like a blanket of silk. It was keeping me cool and relaxed. And I looked, and so yeah, everything was intact. No, not even a bruise or a scratch. So my whole body was fine. But they were, it's like they were healing everything, the trauma that had just happened to me. And they were just like trying to bring me, ground me almost. And when I say ground, I suddenly realized that I was lying on this huge piece of slate. It was like a big sort of almost like a medieval rock altar, you know. It was like very big, is the only way to describe it. Mm-hmm. And normally you would think that that would be a very uncomfortable situation, lying on a piece of slate like that, but it wasn't. It felt remarkably comfortable. And what I realized at this point as well, that I was, the energy I was getting from all these beings and all this light was just pure unconditional love. It was just like this energy of love, you know, all the feelings of love you've ever had in your life, whether it's through your lover, your mother, your father, or even your pet dog or whatever, you know, it was all encompassed into one. And it was just coming through, you know, the energy from these beings and the light itself. Then I suddenly stopped to think to myself, well, what about my family? You know, they're going to be down in the hospital. You know, they're already distressed enough to see what had just happened to me. And they're going to be like, you know, down there looking at me and completely mortified because I was dead.
Yeah.
So I looked over the side, but I didn't. It was odd because before that, my whole life was always filled with guilt. As I just said, I was apologizing to my mother for what had just happened, which was crazy. But I didn't feel any sense of, you know, oh my God, my family. It was just a sense of wanting to check on them. And I looked over the edge of this huge rock, thinking that I would see them, but I didn't see them at all. But what I did see was this most remarkable sight. It was like a huge arc. It was like a waterfall of stars, if you like, a beautiful, massive waterfall. And these stars were just slowly cascading over the edge and dropping down into what seems like other galaxies. And well, into infinity. It just kind of went on and on and on, you know. And the colors that it was dropping down into were just like beautiful. And there was like shooting stars that just seemed to be dropping through the middle. And I just thought, wow. Then I knew that, of course, I wasn't in a small darkened space at all. You know, I was actually in the universe itself, if you like, because that's when I looked around, there were millions of stars everywhere. And and I just thought, wow, this is just like incredible. This is just amazing. You know, it was a very euphoric feeling to be in this place. And as I slowly turned myself over, I thought to myself, well, okay, I can't see them, but I'm going to be seeing them all soon. They'll be, you know, we'll be fine. We'll all get over this. You know, I'll be seeing them up in this place. Or if I don't, at least I know they're going to be enjoying this beautiful experience themselves, you know. Then as I turned over, I suddenly realized at that point that the level and intensity of love that I was experiencing, is suddenly it's like a dial had just turned up to tenfold. And I thought, what is going on now? And then I looked, and just ahead of me was this huge sort of tunnel of white light, a very intense tunnel of light. And it was just slowly edging in towards me. And this tunnel was like surrounded by like flames that were slowly rotating around, very powerful. And, you know, oranges and yellows, all the colors you'd see within fire. But it wasn't like the kind of fire that you would normally feel fear of, you know. There was no sense of danger. It was more like it was just powerful, you know. And I straight away, I knew, as I looked and felt this energy that was really, my whole of my body was just, I could feel every molecule was vibrating from this energy. Mm-hmm. And I thought, now this is God. This is the source of all creation. This is like where it all comes from. It's not the vision of God that we tend to sort of all be given when we're all growing up, you know, like that you see on the ceiling of the Vatican Chapel, you know, with the guy with the beard reaching out his hand. This is God. This is a huge energy of light. So I laid back, and I remember as I put my head back, I was kind of laughing and smiling to myself at all this beauty and knowledge. And it was at that point that I suddenly found myself crashing back down to earth, and I was back in my body in the the emergency department of the hospital with the doctors flying around and the pain suddenly rushing straight up through every part of my body.
So during this time, when you're with these three beings, and then you see the light that you perceive as God, were there any words spoken telepathically or anything, or did you get any impressions, or did you know who these people were?
Yeah, there were no words spoken. I know that I've obviously read up now since, and some people do get words spoken to them, but it was telepathy, really. Mm-hmm. It was all coming through in forms of telepathy. Mm-hmm. And I felt that the initial being that was the most important one was the one that was stood at my feet. I felt that that being was my complete and pure and ultimate soulmate. You know, it was almost like a mirror of myself, because interestingly enough, when I was a child, I had very white blonde hair myself, which was odd because my dad had really jet black hair, you know, and my mum had very dark brown hair. Mm-hmm. It was always a joke, you know, when they used to take me through town, they were going, "Are you sure this is your son?" Yeah. Kind of thing, you know? And so it was almost like there was a very strong form connection. It was basically my higher conscience, if you like, my higher consciousness.
Yeah.
My higher consciousness is what stood there at my feet and was protecting me. And I feel that that being is with me at all times. Yeah.
Any feeling like I want to stay here? Was there any discussion about you coming back, or you just found yourself back?
Well, I was quite happy to stay there. So there was no part of me was saying, I want to go back. When I did come back, there was mixed feelings, because there was a sense of like, oh, wait, why have you sent me back? I was quite happy there, but that only lasted for a short amount of time, because ultimately I was so charged with what had just happened that I just couldn't wait to tell the world. And I figured that at that point, I'd never heard of near-death experiences. I never knew that this happened to people. And I figured at that point, I was the only one that this had happened to.
Okay.
So yeah. I figured, right, you know, I didn't come back, you know, with this kind of ego sort of sense of, right, I'm special. Don't get me wrong. But I just figured, right, this has happened. Now, why have they sent me back? What is my mission? From the off, I thought, what am I supposed to do now? And I spent most of my time in hospital trying to figure that one out.
I'm going to, Dave, if you don't mind, I'm going to interrupt you for a second. I wanted to share some of your paintings so people can get an idea of what we're talking about.
Great.
So let me share my screen here. And for people watching on YouTube, you'll be able to see these. So this is the scene that David talked about. And I think you did. It's amazing to me that you captured this, and you've got no artistic training, and you'd never painted before.
That's right. That's the very first one I did, actually, that you've got up at the moment.
So I think this says, so this is here, the being, we got the being that you said is the kind of androgynous being with the white hair.
That's
and
it,
these,
yeah.
These
yeah.
are the two women.
These are the two women there. Yeah.
And the slab. Yeah. I mean, I looked at your paintings and I'm like, I'm not an art critic, but they look pretty amazing to me. Kind of depicts the scene at the accident. That's how your left arm was splayed. Yeah,
that's right. That's what I saw. I saw the inside of my whole arm, and rather than feeling horrified by what I saw, I was actually going, wow, that's the whole of the inside of my arm. That's how it all works. I could see every single nerve ending and what have you. So I wanted to paint that. That was the second painting I did. Mm-hmm. But I also had to do that one because even though I'd had the near-death experience, which had obviously changed my life, I'm a human being, you know, I'd just been thrown under a train, and which was, I had to deal with that and process it. So that painting was also part of me processing what had happened in the actual accident.
The trauma that you went through. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. You know, so that's
and while we're looking at your paintings, I did have a question for you, because you don't mention in your NDE that you saw Jesus, but I see a painting here that is that,
what is
this painting?
Yeah, that is Christ up done there. Yeah. No, okay. And that came about because, a little later on, I came across a spiritualist church in the town where I was staying, where I now live. And I wanted to go in there. And I went through the door, and I went into one of their services, and it was really beautiful. Mm-hmm. And at the end, one of them turned around and said, look, we don't normally say this, invite people along, but you look in a pretty bad way. And I got all this stuff holding my arm together at that point. And they said, we do spiritual healing. I said, oh, great. So I started going for spiritual healing. And through some of those healers are also clairvoyant, and they would just give small messages at the end of the session sometimes, and they pick things up. And there was once I was in there having some healing, you know, I'd see the halo there in that's some of the images that I would see, images of light while I was being healed. But in one of the sessions I saw Christ and just like as I painted him there, just kind of hovering above me.
Wow.
And so I came to the end of that healing session, and the person who was healing me turned around and said, oh, do you know that Christ was with you? I said, Christ. And so she felt exactly the same. And it was just so remarkable that I had to go home and start painting that straight away. So that's where that
And I'm going to share one more. This is the, I guess this is the tunnel that you saw, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, just incredible work how you were, you know, able to capture that. And I was telling you before we got started, I think one thing about NDEs, a lot of times people dismiss them as the, you know, the hallucinations of a dying brain, or it's a dream that you had, or or whatever. Mm-hmm. But what it's interesting when people have what I call, or what's called vertical NDEs, where, you know, sometimes people can describe something that happened while they were supposedly dead. But there's also the after effects of NDEs. Some people come back with mediumistic abilities. Some people come back with enhanced abilities to for intellectual or spiritual. They can see things. And you came back with this ability to, and desire, I guess, even to paint. Mm,
it was, yeah. Yeah, the desire was there right from the off. I remember my sister coming in to see me the very first night after I had the operation. I was in for about 8 hours, and then she came in the following night, I should say. And I was in a room, they're giving me a room to myself. I remember we were both chatting, and she said, "Look, is there anything I can get you?" And I said, "Yeah, can you get me like a small sketch pad and a pencil?" She went, "Okay," you know, so you're thinking, all right, you know. And I remember I got the nurses to prop me up in the bed, and I did this very faint sketch of what you saw in that first painting, basically, because at that point I was really scared I was going to lose it and forget it all, because it was mm-hmm. just so important. But of course, I never have done. But, you know, so, but also I just figured I was lying in that bed and I thought, I've got to paint a huge canvas. This has got to be something like a big Michelangelo sort of Renaissance painting, you know?
Yeah.
It's got to be big. And so that was my, and that's exactly what I did. My aunt came over from Canada, I remember, to see me, and I was chatting about all about it, and she said, "I'm going to buy you a canvas." And so she bought me the canvas, you know. And yeah, in all fairness, you know, I left it stood against the wall for a while, very nervous about starting it, because obviously mm-hmm. I thought I could just make a real mess of this. But a friend of my sister's came along, and her and her husband ran this kind of a gym and yoga center. And they said, "Look, we've got a studio space going. If you want to come up and use one of our rooms, then you can get started." She knew that I was putting it off. And I went, okay, so I've got no choice but to start. And when I started, I couldn't believe it. It was just coming together, you know, so beautifully for me, you know. And I'd start to at the end of each day, I'd literally sit in a chair and look at my canvas and I go, wow. And I knew at that point that I was being helped, that I knew the energy that from the other side that I'd been to was just giving me some knowledge of how to be able to translate what I'd seen onto a canvas. Mm-hmm. And it went from there. And so I now connect, you know, with everything I do. I'm very aware that I'm channeling ideas through, and that connection stays with you.
Yeah. And so the other thing I wanted to point out, because I was reading the book, it kind of reads like a novel, because we got some foreshadowing here too. Before you even have the accident, you have an experience at a spiritualist church. So tell me about that.
Yeah, well, that was just kind of like you might call a fluke or synchronicity, as mm-hmm. I put it, really, because I was coming, it was in the same town. I was coming up a couple of months before the accident to visit my sister one weekend. Mm-hmm. And I was on the train and I was sat there, and there was an elderly couple sat opposite me. And the lady turned around asking me where the next station was or what have you, you know. And then she turned around and said, "We're going to see a medium tonight." And I was going, okay. And I just really wasn't interested in engaging in conversation at that point, but she was quite keen to carry on that conversation. Mm-hmm. She said, "Very good. You know, she really is," and stuff. I said, okay. And then as we got off the train, she handed me the flyer, you know, little A5 poster or what have you. And I put it in my pocket and forgot all about it. And when I turned up to my sister's, there was a lot going on there. She was sorting out the kids and stuff. So I said, "Look, I'm just going to go and have a drink." So I went to the local bar, had a drink, and then I thought, I'm going to go. So I went to this medium platform, as we call it here. And it was like in this spiritualist church, and it was packed. It was absolutely packed. And people were going there looking for messages. They'd just lost their loved ones. And messages were coming through. You know, she was brilliant. She really was great. I thought, wow, that's amazing. But I wasn't looking for anything at that point at all. But she turned around and said, "Man in the blue sweater over there, your life's about to change." And I went, "Oh, okay." And I said, in what way? And then she walked around. She was going like this. And then she said, "They're not telling me. They're not telling me. They just said, be ready for it. It's going to be big. Just be ready for it." And I said, "Fine, great." And I figured, right, I'm going to win the lottery, or, you know, I'm going to get the girlfriend that I was hoping for. I was chasing it. You know, all the material things that I wanted out of life. But obviously that they never came, all those things. And my life was spiraling downhill. But now I realize, looking back, that what that message was coming from the medium was basically that I was going to go under a train. I was going to have a near-death experience. And that was going to change my life. That was the big change that she was mm-hmm. talking about, or they were talking about, I should say. So, yeah, so that was my first venture into spirituality. Before that, it hadn't even entered my mind. You know, really, faith or religion hadn't really sort of been a part of my life at all, you know.
So. Yeah, you know, it's interesting, Dave, you know, these little things that people do, like this woman handing you a flyer, which, you know, you on a whim go to a spiritual church, which kind of gives you the heads up a little bit this is coming. So, and then the way you found the studio where you started, you know, you started painting, that was kind of a, as you said, that was another synchronicity. You run in these people that just happen to have a studio and you get the paint, you start painting. So how did you get into the music? I mean, so you've got the ability to paint and now you start composing classical music.
We'll get back to Grief to Growth in just a few seconds. Did you know that Brian is an author and a life coach? If you're grieving or know someone who is grieving, his book, Grief to Growth, is a best-selling, easy-to-read book that might help you or someone you know. People work with Brian as a life coach to break through barriers and live their best lives. You can find out more about Brian and what he offers at www.grieftogrowth.com, www.grief2growth.com, or text GROWTH, GROWTH, to 31996. If you'd like to support this podcast, visit www.patreon.com/grieftogrowth, www.patreon.com/GRIEF2GROWTH to make a financial contribution. And now, back to Grief to Growth.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey there, something I want to tell you about today. My podcast platform, Buzzsprout, has recently made it easier for me to allow you to support me financially. Go to www.grieftogrowth.com/subscribe. That's grieftogrowth.com/subscribe. And once you're there, you can sign up to support me financially. Now, you can do it for as little as $3 a month or, of course, as much as you'd like. If you do that, you'll get access to bonus episodes, and you'll see those in the regular feed. They'll have a lock on them. But when you become a subscriber, you'll actually get access to your own private feed, and you'll be able to listen to the regular podcast along with the bonus podcast for the subscribers. I want to thank you for listening. I want to thank you for sharing the podcast. And I want to thank those of you who support me financially. Have a great day, and on to the episode.
Yeah, well, before I used to play guitar, like just basic three chord sort of punk rock and roll stuff, you know. And but I couldn't play guitar anymore because of my left arm accident injury. And so, but what happened was through one of these healing sessions, well, one or two of them actually, a couple of the healers kept saying to me each week, "Oh, well, why am I picking up a violin laid across your chest?" I was going, "I have no idea." Then one of them said, "You're going to write a piece of music about your experience." That's what they're telling me. And I was going, great. So I went home and I pulled out this, I had this old cheap synthesizer, you know, in the back of the cupboard or whatever. And I pulled that out and started playing around on that. And these chords came through. And I figured at that point I would be writing, okay, a piece of music. I thought you meant like a three-minute song, you know.
Yeah.
And I was trying to get this song together. And interestingly enough, it just wasn't coming as that at all. I thought, this is sounding more like it could be played by an orchestra or something. You know, it was sounding more like that. And I started building on that and getting it together. And by that point, at the place I was doing the paintings, I'd met a girl who played cello in the local orchestra who was coming up and looking at my paintings. People used to come in to the center and used to come up. They were fascinated by what was going on. Mm-hmm. And she was one of them. And she said, "Can we use one of your paintings for a poster for our next concert?" I said, "Yeah, sure. It would be brilliant." Yeah. Mm-hmm. And she said, "What are you up to?" We used to meet for coffee. And I said, "Look, I'm just writing this piece of music. And it feels like it could be played by an orchestra." And I got no intention of trying to push it at all. But she said, "Oh, maybe we could play it." And I was going, okay, I'm going to hold you to that kind of thing in my mind. So I just developed it and got the first movement together. And my brother at this point turned around to me and he said, "Look, I've got this, it's like an app or what have you, you know, that you can use on your laptop. And when you play your keyboard, the notes that you're playing on the keyboard, it will, you know, then transform it into notation. Mm-hmm. So that's what I did. And so I started hearing all different instruments coming through, like horns and flutes. And then I recognized that had to be a French horn, for example, or a piccolo. And then I just got it to sort of transform all these parts. And then I spoke to this girl again from the orchestra. I said, look, I've actually got some score. Would you look at it? And she said, yeah. So she brought one of the other guys along from the orchestra, and we had a meeting, and they looked at the score. They went quiet for some time, and they said, yeah, we'll do it. So they offered to perform it. And then they said, it was great, because they said to me, look, do you mind just chatting to the local press? Because we always do something there to promote the concert. I said, sure. So once I started talking to the local press and told them what the story was, because the piece was actually about my near-death experience, and everyone knew about the accident locally because it had been all over the news, you know, this guy gone under a train and what have you. So they were going, this is great, you know. And then the phone just kept ringing, and other people started wanting to interview me, and then the BBC wanted to do like a piece on me. So the concert consequently sold out 2 weeks in advance,
yeah,
which was fantastic, you know, for me, but also for the orchestra as well. So it was a brilliant vibe between us all. You know, the energy was felt just great, you know. And so the concert, I remember they'd given me and my family the front row, and I was just sat there, and I just enjoyed it because it was great not having to be stood on a stage holding a guitar hoping for the best. So I was actually sat there watching it being performed, you know. And it just sounded amazing. It just sounded how I'd heard it when I was playing this little synthesizer in
kitchen. I have to say, I took piano lessons for 11 years. I've had music theory. I wouldn't even know how to begin to write a symphony. You've got all these different instruments. You've got different sections of the orchestra. It's such an impressive feat that you did this. Even with I saw that you got the app from your brother, so you were able to plink it out in your synthesizer and it converted to notes. But you've got to know piccolo versus a flute and violins and cellos and all these different things and how to bring them together. And then you actually had vocals in the last movement, if I remember correctly.
That's right. Yeah. That was I wanted to get somebody to sing the last part, because I thought it would be really lovely just to have a voice sort of talking about what it's about. And so I approached this guy. I knew he was like one of the best. He ran a choral society, and mm-hmm. he was like one of the best tenor singers in the area. So I phoned him up. I said, look, can I come around and see you? And he said, yeah. And I took the score round, and I said, look, I'm looking for someone to sing it. Could you recommend anybody? And he looked at it. He said, this is great. He said, and he was saying stuff that I know about theory. He was going, how did you manage to think of putting like a minor seventh over a
that's a what I'm saying
flat or whatever, you know? And I was going, I don't know. He said, well, he said, that's great, because you wouldn't normally do that, but it works.
Right.
And then he said, I'll sing it myself. And I was going, really? Oh, fantastic. And, you know, you probably heard he's got a really beautiful, pure voice. And so that was it. So, he just turned up at the rehearsal, did one run through, and it was there. You know, there was one or two bits where I'd written it wrong in terms of like, you know, but not hardly anything at all. And that was it. So one rehearsal and we were off. So, and he actually turned around. He was interviewed by the BBC afterwards because they knew who he was. Mm-hmm. And he turned around and said, well, you know, I wanted to do this because, you know, I knew all about David's accident, and he said, I was just so impressed how he could just step out of his comfort zone and produce something like this. He said, I wouldn't even begin to start composing a piece myself. And that's what he told me. And I thought, that's mad. You've got so much knowledge. You know,
right.
I thought you had been writing them all the time. he said, I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't attempt it. So, but again, I was channeling ideas through. I knew they were coming through from somewhere. And by that stage, you know, I would just stop. And as I do now, when ideas come through, I literally stop and I look up and I go, thank you so much. You know, because it's just, you know, that acknowledgement is important, I feel. So, yeah.
There was a point in your book when you met with Joy at the spiritual church, one of the healers. And you that's when I think you kind of got a lesson about unconditional love. Yeah. Tell me about that.
Well, basically, I realized through my near-death experience, and she helped me to sort of, you know, we talked about it and understand it even more, what had happened to me. And that was before my near-death experience. I'd got no sense of self-love. And so my life was completely going wrong all the time. I'd left school without any qualifications. So I was struggling to get by. And I just never fitted in at all. So rather than give myself any self-love or self-worth, I just kept beating myself up. So that's where it was all going wrong. So she helped me to understand that she knew that when she was healing me. She could feel that still, that, you know, that, that I'd suffered a lot of pain throughout my life. And that self-love was the most important lesson for us all to learn, and unconditional love as well. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I just realized this, the names of the people in your book, are they their real names, Joy and Irene?
Yeah. I mean, one or two of them have changed. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
I'm just curious. It's interesting. Her name is Joy. And then Irene, your psychiatrist, her name means peace. So I don't know if you knew that. Okay. Yeah. I thought Irene was really interesting too. And I love the story with Irene. She's because she doesn't really believe that you had this experience, right? She's just kind of humoring you. So
I love this. She's humoring me. Yeah, come on, carry on, please.
I love the story when you talk, when she talks to you about the card reader, the guy, the tarot reader that she had met.
The what, sorry?
The tarot reader, the card reader that she had met that told her about.
Yeah.
So tell us about that, because I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. Well, basically, I wanted to sort of track down the medium who I'd seen, you know, a couple of months before, and it took me ages to find it because I kept describing it to the people in the church. Mm-hmm. I said, "She's got dark hair." I go, "No." You know, and then she turned up one Sunday, and there she was, but she dyed her hair blonde, so that's why nobody knew who I was talking about. Mm-hmm. So I went up and talked to her afterwards and said, "Look, you know, I don't know if you remember, but and she." She hadn't recalled it at all, you know, but I said what had happened, that she'd given me this message, and then I told her what happened. So she said, I do tarot card readings. I said, yeah, I know. I said, could I get one off you then? And she said, yeah, I want to give you one for free. I'm not charging you. And so she gave me this amazing tarot card reading, and it was really brilliant. But in terms of Irene, you know, it's like, I could tell, I mean, I totally respect anyone coming from the scientific point of view, certainly, because I needed that, and we all need it, you know, and without them, I wouldn't be here now talking to you. But every time I brought up spirituality or talked about things like this, like she was, I could see that she was kind of like getting almost a bit nervous. She's like, yeah, let's move on. Mm-hmm. But I thought, no, this is part of my life. I can't just move on, you know? And so I could tell that she knew that, and that as part of her was like, almost like, I wasn't trying to convert her or anything like that.
But right.
I knew that ultimately that there was just, you know, she respected that what I was talking about was had happened, but she just couldn't turn around and say it, you know.
I thought was really interesting about, and I like I said, I think her that mentality is really important in this world. We need to be skeptical. I think it's good to be skeptical. And as I said, as I'm reading your story, I'm like, okay, what am I seeing here? Okay, so I see, first of all, you come back with the ability to paint, ability to write symphonies. You were drinking quite a bit before this, and you stopped drinking. You really kind of turned your life around. So as you know, I'm thinking of her, put myself in her place as she's watching you go through this, and she tells you the story about she had seen a tarot reader, and I guess he predicted she was going to make a career change, which she ended up making, and then she still says, well, maybe that was a self-fulfilling prophecy. So I thought that story that you told in the book was really interesting about how she actually had evidence that someone had given her this prediction, which came true, but she just kind of dismissed it, which I think we can tend to do.
Yeah.
So I thought that was an interesting part of the book. Great, you know, character interplays that you have as you're going through this experience that you went through. So after you've gone through this, how has your life changed? I mean, you were told by the medium you're going to have this big life change. So, in what ways has your life changed?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hi there. I'm really excited to tell you about my latest ebook. It's 4 lessons that you can learn from the near-death experience without going through all the trouble of dying to learn them. I've been studying NDEs for several years now. I am completely convinced that not only are they 100% real, but that there's some very universal wisdom that we can get from the near-death experience. And I've distilled that down in this book into four short lessons. And I've also given you all the reasons why I believe that NDEs are absolutely real. So go to www.grieftogrowth.com/NDE lessons to pick it up for free. www.grief2growth.com/NDE lessons. I hope you enjoy it.
Well, as I say before, I got no real faith in anything. I haven't got any faith in myself either. And I guess I was just, everything that was going wrong in my life, I was looking for the quick fix, i.e., as you just pointed out there from the book, you know, I was drinking heavily, and mm-hmm. and that eventually can start to consume me. I mean, I was picking up mainly sort of manual laboring work, and that kind of work, you had to go to the local bar, basically. That was like the office. So you go in there to hustle work, you know, after the guys and say, what's going, what's happening, you know. Mm-hmm. So you ended up hustling for work, you get the job, and then you're just there the next day and you're just drinking your wages away, you know. So it's this vicious circle. And eventually I spiraled into complete, you know, a non-entity. And but the thing is, I was just, as I say, I was beating myself up. I was never attacking anyone else. I never let my own anxieties out on others. It was always me that I was beating myself up with, you know. But after the NDE, it was completely the opposite. I'd learned self-love, and that self-love gave me this completely different outlook on life. I'd learned to love everything that was around me. You know, I learned to appreciate nature. You know, I learned to paint, I learned to sort of create music, and suddenly my whole life now feels like three-dimensional compared to before, where it was just this one dimension. And I when I look back, basically all I was doing was just, it was linear. I was just going along the surface and trying to fill the cracks, whereas now it's kind of, you know, it's not all great all the time, obviously, you know, that's impossible, but
yeah.
But I ride in when I take the dips, I go with it. I learned that I've got to go with that, and that I will come out again. And I just, you know, and I just know that my guides are there, and I never feel like they've left me, even when things go wrong, you know. So yeah, so it's just more three dimensional and a lot more fulfilling, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That kind of leads me into the next question I was going to ask you, was what do you think your experience can teach all of us about life? And I think you just kind of answer at least one of those things, is that we go through these ups and downs, but we're going to be okay. We're never really alone.
Yeah. Say that again. Sorry.
We're saying that, you know, as you're going through these ups and downs, I think you've realized now that we're never really alone. You feel like, you know, you've got these, and we all have these guides that you have. We all have that comfort and that love that we sometimes might not feel.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. This is something that I'm really keen to sort of press to everyone whoever I speak to, you know, just around me or whatever. And that mm-hmm. is that you don't have to have a traumatic accident like me or an NDE to be in touch with your guides. We've all got them, and we can all call upon them, basically. And it's nothing too difficult, and it shouldn't be something that's made difficult. I think that when I look at a lot of the way, faith and the way we've been brought up, a lot of us have been felt that, if you're going to if you're going to pray, for example, then you're in a position where you're feeling like, oh, I'm asking for this help, I hope you don't mind. You know what I mean? When I ask, I'm humble, but only in the sense that I'm humble showing respect, like as if the same kind of respect I'd be humble with anybody who was helping me, mm-hmm. you know, on the earth plane or whatever you call it, you know, I'd be humble. But I don't kind of go in with this kind of feeling like I'm a sinner, that I've sinned, that I've got to feel a sense of urgency and guilt, you know. Just be clear and ask your guides for any help, even if it's something small, even if you're just nervous about, you know, something that's going on that day. Just ask, say, oh, can you help me please with this one, you know, this is tricky for me, and they will come and help you.
Yeah. So you do believe in the power of prayer now, and
yeah,
so prayer, tell me more about that. How does prayer work?
Right, well, I discovered that pretty much straight away, because after the trainer moved on from that point in the accident, my friend Anna was frantically trying to find somebody to stop it, stop the train, you know, and then she bumped into like a ticket collector, and he ran forward and stopped it. She said there was just sat in the middle of nowhere on this carriage, and there was like this emptiness, and she said there was just not emptiness, so quietness and not emptiness, and they were just out there in the middle of nowhere. And she said she turned around to this very busy carriage full of commuters and said, "Could we say a prayer, please, for my friend who's just died? He's just gone under the train," because she didn't think I would have survived it.
Yeah.
And then she said, a woman stepped forward and said, "Look, I'm a Christian. Would you like me to take the prayers?" And she said, "Please." And so she said, this woman just took these prayers. And she said, it was amazing just seeing everyone close their laptops, put their newspapers down, and everyone prayed for me. And I felt that energy coming from them. And also my mother told me that various churches in the small sort of villages surrounding where we lived and that were all praying. And I knew it because I could feel it all throughout those early days in the hospital of when I was in agony. I could feel this energy of prayer. So I firmly believe that prayer does work. So, you know, if anybody turns around to me now and says, "Look, you know, a friend of mine, her son, whatever, is in hospital." That happened over Christmas, actually. Mm-hmm. It was a friend of a friend. So I said, "Look, somebody's in, her son's really ill in hospital." She was trying to get everyone to come together, you know, and pray for him. So I said, "Yeah." And we all did. We all sent out all these prayers. And I worked really hard at praying for this boy that I'd never met before. And I just looked at his photograph online and just visualized him. And you know what? He came through it. He came through the other side. And he was like in a coma. And it was like, you know, it works. It does work, you know. So there's so much more out there. The way the energy of the universe works is just so incredible, you know. And we're not all educated in ourselves. Or not educated, that's the wrong word. But, you know, we don't have that instinct to know that. And it's very hard to try and understand it. But it is quite simply what happens, you know. If we believe and trust in the universe, it will help us all.
Yeah, I think what you said there is actually very true. I think it's very important. I think we do have that instinct, but we're kind of educated out of it. We're told that we're separate individual beings and there is nothing out there. There is no connection to the other side. And I think that's why a lot of us feel so lonely and unempowered, you know? So when someone goes through like what you go through, you've tapped into that other side and you seem to keep that connection even as you're back here now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just been part of my life every single day since. And, you know, going back to, you know, scientists who, or what have you, or skeptics on near-death experiences, is that the way I look at it is that if it had been a hallucination or a dream or what have you, you know, I would have forgotten all about it by now, you know what I mean? It wouldn't be that important to me just to still be talking about it. And it wouldn't have changed my life the way it changed. And, you know, dream state as well. The dreams are generally chaotic and, you know, lack form, whereas like a near-death experience it's real and it's very sort of intensely consistent, you know, and it's like you know that you're there. Okay, it's a different dimension. It doesn't feel like you and I are sat here talking now, but it was as clear as you and I are talking now. And every other people that I've spoken to since who've had NDEs agree with that. You know, there's this common thing as well that when you talk to other people, yes, everyone's different. You know, everyone's got a different story with their near-death experiences, but there's so many similarities. You know, we've come off air or whatever, and we've been chatting. I've been interviewed by a few people who've had NDEs, and then we chat afterwards, and they go, "Oh, how did you feel when you were in the hospital when you came through after the operation?" And I talk about it, and she's going, "Yeah, me too. I had that energy that, you know, I just couldn't wait to tell the world all the same things." And, you know, so it's a very consistency that's going on there between us all. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you know, there's some, you know, there's the stereotypical, I guess, you know, the tunnel of light, the light life review, the meeting of loved ones. But all these things don't occur in all NDEs, but they're very common. But the one thing that is common across all NDEs is unconditional love. The lesson of unconditional love and the unconditional love that's usually felt on the other side. And people that see an entity that they describe as God or source or creator, it's always, there's usually light associated with it. And it's just an overwhelming feeling of love or of being at home. I mean, those are the things that are just kind of at the root of the NDE. But as I was telling you before we went on air, the thing about your NDE that to me is undeniable is the life changes that you experience afterwards. People don't have life changes after having a hallucination. They don't have life. They don't get suddenly get abilities that were lying dormant, you know, that now I can paint and I can, you know, write symphonies. Those things don't happen when people just, you know, go into a coma or something.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, generally speaking, I mean, people who've had NDEs, they don't all come back and paint or write music, but a lot of them do change where they want to talk about it, and they end up getting on platforms and you know, talking about it at conferences and things like that. And you know, there are scientists who's, you know, Dr. Eben Alexander's, you know, one of the classic ones with the biggest seller, you know, he was like a neurosurgeon, and you know, so he should be a skeptic, if you like, but he's not. So he's obviously, that's why he's a big seller. But he, you know, it's changed his life in as much as he's gone from just being that to also wanting to go out there and talk about it to the world. So, you know, it affects many of us in many different ways. I mean, there are some people who've had near-death experiences who've got in touch with me, but they've kind of kept quiet about it. I mean, I remember meeting a guy in the hospital. Because when I was recovering, we used to go into like this, like a gym, and everyone in there, they're all amputees. They'd all, you know, had horrific accidents and stuff. So they were trying to help us all back. Mm. And this guy had come off a motorbike, you know, he'd been chased by the police, and he was going along the highway and came off at 125 miles an hour. Mm. And again, shouldn't have survived, but he did. Mm. And I'd gone in there and I'd told them, we used to have coffee at the end of each session, and I told them the story when I was having the coffee one day. And that was like the first group of strangers that I told, and they were so captive, and everyone was asking me questions. Everyone was really tuned into it and thought it was amazing. And then I just kind of remember going away thinking, that it just felt great, you know, that everyone wanted to know rather than dismissing it. And I just sat down on my own, and this guy came over to me. I'd come off the bike, and he said, mate, he said, that story you just told. I said, yeah, he said, yeah, that happened to me. Mm. Same thing. I was going, really? I said, right. I said, have you told anyone? And he went, no way. He said, I said, why not? He said, no, everyone would just think I was crazy. I said, no, you've got to talk about it, you know. And I've never seen him since, but I kind of get the feeling that he probably wouldn't have done, and which is sad, because it's like he'd been given a second chance, an opportunity to sort of, you know, well, maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. But it didn't feel like I was convincing him to actually open up to his mates about it. So I wonder how many people are out there who've had near-death experiences and haven't really, or not, has acted upon it, if you like. So I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, there are those people, and it's interesting as life has changed and has become more common, and we're learning about it. People are kind of coming out of the closet, you know, and talking about it. And I saw that. Dr. Moody actually wrote the foreword for your book, you know, Raymond Moody, who coined the term near-death experience in the late 70s. So, but still, as you said, even when you had your experience, which was it 2006?
Yeah, that's right.
You know, you hadn't heard the term. It's still not known by a lot of people. And the circles I run in, it's like we accept it as just common.
Yeah.
Most people don't realize how common the near-death experience really is. But thanks to people like you who are, you know, going out and writing books and being willing to be open about it, people are starting to understand.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, you know, for me, I just want to try and sort of get the message out there to as many people as possible about it. It's been my quest right from the off. And also to tell people not, you know, to try and educate, to tell people not to fear death, basically. Mm-hmm. In fact, I was interviewed by somebody who contacted me from the Guardian newspaper, which is like over here, it's quite a big paper, and she was doing a short series of films all about her fear of death. And so she came up from London and spent some time with me, you know, and she was genuinely very scared of dying, to the point that, you know, she would go to sleep nearly every night worried about it, you know. And I was just so I tried my best to sort of like tell my story and try and help her through it and stuff, and I've realized since that the people have got in touch with me and are now, you know, since I've been doing more interviews and stuff and genuinely fear death. Well, not only that, they've just lost somebody, you know, they've lost a loved one, and they're looking for that hope that, that their loved ones are safe. So it's lovely to be able to talk about my story. And then, you know, I've had people say that's really helped me because I've just lost a loved one. And it's really, it's great to know that there is an afterlife and that they're being cared for, because it's really important for us all to know that, because I feel that we don't really talk about death enough. I'm not saying we should get up every morning, chat about it over our coffee, but it's a taboo subject in the Western world, you know, and it's just, and it has been since medieval times, you know, when there was a lot of people dying at that point. So that's how it was talked about a lot more. So it's something that I feel that we should all just like sort of just chat about with people like myself and or people like you, you know, just and just debate it for a short amount of time, if you like. It doesn't have to be, and just so that people know that it's going to happen to us all eventually, and or we're going to all start losing loved ones around us in our families. Mm-hmm. It's just to know that there's that, it's okay, you know, it's all right. I mean, I lost my mother last summer. And of course, went through it. Thank you. You know, I went through the physical, you know, loss of, you know, my mother and stuff that brought me into the world. But I instantly knew where she'd gone. And it was so reassuring for me to have that first-hand knowledge. It felt great to know that she was receiving all that beautiful love on the other side that I'd had. Yeah. But it would be great just to be able to just say to everybody, you know, this is that's it. Yeah, please don't fear what's happened to you, your loved ones, because they're being cared for in a much better way than a lot of us are down here.
Yeah. So David, what is your life like now? What are you doing? Are you painting? Are you selling your paintings? Or
yeah. Well, I've written a book. So and as you pointed out, so there's been a lot of time spent really putting the promotion together for that, because I'm sure, I'm trying to get the energy out there to as many people as possible. But I'm also writing a new piece of music as well for orchestra, because I've written quite a few since that one, and got commissions. So this one, which is entitled "I Wasn't Expecting This," and that's a new piece for orchestra. So that's coming together really well. That's again, there's a lot of divine energy coming into that for me, and so
that's awesome.
Yeah,
that's awesome. I'm really great. So, how about your painting? You're still painting?
Yeah, I still paint. Yeah. And I just finished off a painting for somebody who commissioned me to write to do a painting for her company. She does like a. I was invited out to the south of France last summer to talk to a group of people who are on a retreat, and all these people they're all women actually, and they're all end of life doulas. You know, they're like sort of soul midwives, and I'd never heard of them before, so that was a new one to me. And it was great. So they asked me to go out there and talk about my experience. And when I was out there, the person who was running this retreat, called Holly, runs her own sort of funeral director's company. But the way her funeral directing is done is really beautiful. They, you know, where they wash the body and care for it and send it off to the other side. So anyway, so she asked me to paint a new logo for her. So that's the last piece of work I've just done. And that was awesome. Really enjoyable and beautiful doing it, because I felt so moved by all the work she does. Mm-hmm. And because it was just great seeing, you know, that she's treating death in the same kind of way that I'm talking about, that she's helping the soul to move on, basically.
Yeah.
Which is great, you know, because for years and years, go on.
Yeah, the death doula thing is really great, and I think we are starting in the West to accept death as just a transition, which is what you're telling us it is. It's not an end. It's the next phase of life, I think, is the way a lot of people are putting it. Yeah, so absolutely. I'm really, really glad to see you, you know, putting yourself out there and telling your story and being part of that. And I want to encourage people to get the book. It's a fantastic book. It's a great read. So it's called Shine On, The Remarkable Story of How I Fell Under a Moving Train, Journey to the Afterlife, and the Astonishing Proof I Brought Back with Me. It's by David Ditchfield. It's DITCHFIELD. And David's website is shineonthestory.com. And I previewed some of the paintings there. If you're listening to this and you're not watching it on YouTube, you can watch the YouTube video, or you can go to David's website and see some of the paintings there that are really, truly amazing.
Thank you.
So, Dave, it's been really great having you on, getting to meet you. Like I said, I really enjoyed the book. So I'm encouraging people again, you know, to get the book and to follow you.
Thank you so much.
Your work. I appreciate what you're doing for the world, for letting us, you know, feel more comfortable about the transitions you said we're all going to face.
Yeah. Thanks a lot. That's beautiful that you just said about my work, by the way, just saying. I'm very humbled. That's great. Thanks.
Well, you know, like I said, I think it's clear evidence to me of what you experienced. And I think and I'm glad you're sharing it with the world, because for people that are even skeptics, if you're a skeptic, get the book, read the book, look at David's website, and you explain to me how he got these abilities if something really crazy didn't happen.
Great. Thanks.
Well, David, you enjoy the rest of your day. It's been great meeting you.
You too. Oh, it's great meeting you as well. Lovely chatting as well.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye now.
Well, I hope you enjoyed the episode. I want to make it really easy for you to reach me. So just send me a text to 31996 and simply text the word growth, GROWTH. In fact, you can right now just say, "Hey Siri, send a message to 31996. And when Siri asks you what you want to send, just say growth. You can do the same thing with OK Google. Thanks a lot. Have a wonderful day.
Thanks for listening to Grief to Growth. Brian hopes that you find this episode helpful and will come back for future episodes. Brian's best-selling book, Grief to Growth, Planted, Not Buried, is a great resource for anyone who is coping with grief or knows someone who is. If you enjoy the podcast and would like to support it, there are three things you can do to help. The first is to share the podcast with someone that you think it will help. The second is to go to iTunes, rate, and review the episode. The third way you can support the podcast is by becoming a patron. Head over to www.patreon.com/grief2growth. That's patreon.com/grief, the number 2, growth, and sign up to make a small monthly donation. Patrons get access to exclusive bonus content and knowledge that you are helping to spread the message of grief to growth. For more about Brian and Grief to Growth, visit www.grief2growth.com.
Hey there, if you liked this episode, come on over and talk about it. Let me know what you liked. If you didn't like this episode, come on over and talk about it. Let me know what you didn't like. Go to grief2growth.com/community and look for Talk About the Podcast. I'll see you there.